Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Cinemantics, the podcast about movies good and bad, mostly bad. I'm your hosting, Melton, and with me this evening...
I'm Shecky Chucklestein, beloved comedian, actor, and barbecue sauce spokesman.
Okay.
No, I'm Jeff Heatherly.
Host of the original, unoriginal podcast.
Yes.
Tonight is somewhat of a special episode because it covers a newly released film, and we haven't done that since the first episode.
Well, the first episode. Don't let iTunes fool you.
Yeah, iTunes has, for some reason, made episodes 1 through, 11 of this show...
backwards.
List backwards on the iTunes store. So it looks like this is, show... 12, but it's really show number 1, Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah.
When we recorded that was the day it came out. And that is the same thing with this film. It is the day it came out.
Yes.
It is Friday, February 19th, I believe.
Yes.
2009, and the film is...
2010! Ah!
Aha! Yeah, I always get off by a couple of years. Whenever I'm talking about years. Okay, the film is Martin Scorsese's Shutter Island, and first off, I want to talk to you, or rather have you explain your trepidation toward this film before you saw it.
You want me to go ahead? Because, it kind of spoils something for me to say.
I'm going to try and say that we should probably keep spoilers to a minimum, but if we can, discuss...
That's the problem, because my issue is kind of a spoiler.
Can we discuss the spoiler without telling people what the spoiler is? Or should we just drop the spoiler nuke?
I'm going to try to do it without the spoiler.
Okay. By the time this episode posts, it will have been out for just...
About 2.5 weeks.
Two and a half weeks-ish. So, people will have had a chance to see it. So, just in case, I'm going to drop the spoiler bomb now, but hopefully we can avoid anything too spoilerific. Go.
Okay. My original problem with this film... it all comes down to promotion. Now, we've talked about on both my podcast and yours about how promotion has been the death of a lot of film experiences for me, Shaun of the Dead being the best example. But this was a situation where when the first trailer hit sometime last year, I want to say it's been actually quite a while because I remember seeing the first trailer when my other roommates used to live here, I feel like. But regardless, it's been a while. And when that first trailer hit, I looked at that thing and I said, well, wow, way to give away the ending. Right there. I felt like it telegraphed what in most... I gotta try to restate this knowing what I know now. Having seen the film, I now hold only the advertisers responsible. And not Scorsese himself or the film itself or the story itself. I don't hold any of them responsible. I hold the advertisers responsible. Because the way they promoted it, one... made it seem like they had telegraphed the ending, which they did a little bit, but not completely. But at the same time, it also made it look like it was going to be Martin Scorsese's attempt to do an M. Night Shyamalan movie, where it was going to be oh, what a twist! I kind of how the audacity, the unmitigated gall of this trailer to try to tell me it has a twist, and then just go ahead and tell me the twist. I was insulted a little bit. I didn't have a massive prejudicial hatred for this movie, but my interest plunged immediately. And months have gone on, and there's been better trailers since for this movie, better TV spots that have sort of hidden the fairly obvious ending that's not a twist, but it just is. And having seen it now, Well, let's just talk about the movie now, Nick.
Okay, the movie is based on a novel by Dennis Lehane. Viewers may know him as the author of Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone. Have you seen those films?
I haven't seen either of those, but can I tell you a little story?
Sure.
Dennis Lehane, I actually, for a long time, had him confused with the co-author of Left Behind.
Really?
There's some guy...
I know who you're talking about, but I'd forgotten what his name was.
I think it's something Lehane, too.
It's like Tim Lehane or something like
that.
Yeah,
and so when I first heard that this movie was based on a book by Dennis Lehane, I was like, wow, the Left Behind guy?
No, the guy who writes good books.
Thank you, Nick. Oh. Thank you so much.
So whatever problems we have with the story or whatnot, it's Lehane's fault and not Martin Scorsese's. We want to just come right off the bat and say that Scorsese has fashioned a hell of a movie out of this story.
It was fantastic.
He nailed the look that the movie needed, he nailed the sound that the movie needed, and he got some surprisingly good performances out of what could have been really over the top and hammy from his actors.
There was even that review you sent me that actually had me worried going in that it was going to be... It said something about how, you know, they portray it as though it's the actual 1950s. Blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, shit. So we're going to have people talking now. Like, now see here, see? Blah, blah, blah. I could just picture that and doing that. And I was like, I was so trepidatious about that. But then to see it, you know, they don't.
Yeah, they don't really talk actually, in noir.
There's
dialogue.
One character who does, but he's like in the first 2 minutes and then he's gone.
Right.
The guard on the boat.
Right.
I'm like, wow. See here, you don't want to go down that road. That road's to Shutter Island. You don't want to go down that road.
No, exactly.
Like, he was so that guy.
And like you mentioned, after the movie, and as we hoped it was going to be into the movie, the twist isn't even the important part. If you can even call it a twist. The important part is how it gets there.
It's all about the journey, Nick.
It's all about the journey. That's what I thought reading the book, especially once I got to the ending. To me, the ending is one of those interesting twists that's like the first twist you see coming from 8 miles away, and then there's like a couple secondary twists afterwards that sort of redeem it.
Yeah.
And I sort of want to talk about that, but we're only 8 minutes in, really.
And you're timid about...
And I'm timid about relating all of these facts so early.
Yeah.
I mean, we did drop the spoiler.
Well,
note, but I mean,
do you want to do the old OUP / greatest movie ever podcast? A protocol of, like, talking about cast first?
Yeah, sure, let's do that.
Okay, that's a safe way to go. So, in this film, I mean, would you like me to do this?
Or? Yeah, sure, go ahead. You've got the cast list out in front of you.
All right, of course. The film stars Leonardo DiCaprio, he's one of our greatest American actors, and becoming more and more every year.
You know, I was commenting after the movie that I really... The more I see of Leonardo DiCaprio, the more I resent James Cameron's Titanic.
Me too.
Because that movie really turned me off to Leonardo DiCaprio, something awful.
Did you ever listen to the second episode of the OUP when we're talking about Titanic being on the Entertainment Weekly list, and how my argument was, that movie made all that money based on the pretense of a teen idol who fizzled out later, because back then I was Rip Torn.
Right. And... Oh, man, I wish Rip Torn had been in this movie.
We wish Rip Torn had been in everything, really.
Yeah.
But anyway, no, I mean, I had a real anger problem with Titanic and Leonardo DiCaprio. But then I saw The Departed, and that changed everything.
Yeah, I think it was The Departed that was, like, made me really sit up and take notice that, wow, he's actually a really good actor.
Yeah.
And everything I've seen with him in it since The Departed has really impressed me. This movie especially, because when you consider the role he has to play, it's a very, very complicated role and a very fine line he has to play if he doesn't want to give away the entire movie.
Yeah, he can give it away with one expression.
Yeah, I mean, like, and you think that it's such a one-note performance, but when you go back and replay the movie in your head, it actually sort of reveals itself as something different. But really, the point was that as great an actor as Leonardo DiCaprio is, it really makes me resent Titanic because it has tainted my opinion of Leonardo DiCaprio so much that even now I can only somewhat get over it. And movies like The Departed and Shutter Island, both of which are Scorsese films, coincidentally, I'm starting to see the error of my ways.
Yeah.
You know. So, yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio, he's pretty good.
He's fantastic. Second build in this picture, Mark Ruffalo as, I didn't even mention his character name, Leonardo DiCaprio is playing U.S. Marshal Teddy Daniels. Mark Ruffalo is his partner, U.S. Marshal Chuck Owl.
Owl, yeah, I don't know how you pronounce
A-U-L-E.
It. They even say it in the movie and I forgot how they said it.
Yeah, me too. But anyway, it's Mark Ruffalo.
Who was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad that he just keeps taking these really... great roles, because, I mean, the first thing I know him from, and the first thing most people know him from, is fucking 13 Going on 30, which, I love that movie, but that's not, like, you know...
No. I remember him from Zodiac, and he was
that was a couple years later, but yeah.
He was in Where the Wild Things Are, briefly.
He was.
You know, he didn't have much to do in Where the Wild Things Are, but that was a great... I mean, opinions are still divided about that movie, but I'm gonna say, as far as 13 Going on 30 and Where the Wild Things Are, I mean... Not to say that 13 Going on 30 is a bad film.
It's a delight.
I haven't seen it.
It's an absolute delight.
But, you know, I'm sure critics would much prefer Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah.
So he's been in several respected films, shall we say.
Yes. Another person who's been in a lot of respected films, but has very recently almost killed his career by being in a lot of shitty, shitty movies, Sir Ben Kingsley, who plays the hospital's chief physician, Dr. John Colley.
And he did a really good job, too.
He certainly did. I had lost a lot of faith in Ben Kingsley after, you know...
After Blood Rain.
Blood Rain, fucking A Sound of Thunder, even... Even Lucky Number 11, which, while it's actually a really well-crafted picture, his role in it is so over-the-top and not in a fun way.
Oh.
I mean, anytime you have a movie where your main villains are played by Ben Kingsley and Morgan Freeman, which it's awesome to watch Morgan Freeman play a villain, because that's just so unexpected.
It's like watching Tom Hanks play a villain.
Yeah, it really is.
I'd love to see Tom Hanks do more dark things.
Yeah, I haven't seen Road to Perdition, but I've heard
it was a really good film. Yeah. I don't remember it well enough to really comment on, you know, if he's actually a good guy who just does dark things or if he's actually just a dark human being.
Yeah.
You know, I've only seen it once, but I remember it being a really good film.
Indeed.
But yes, I think Ben Kingsley has regained some of his clout with this movie because he does a really good job, again, with the role, the whole key of which is keeping the audience deceived.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we'll talk about the twist in a bit more depth later about the build-up and stuff.
Then we'll seriously drop the bomb.
Yeah, we'll seriously drop the bomb then. But he does a really good job at playing the role with just the right amount of like wryness in it, in his tone. You can't really tell if he's serious all the time, but you can't really say without a doubt that, oh, he's hiding something. You're never quite sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And he does a really good job with that quality.
There's not a moment of this film where Ben Kingsley isn't kind of charming.
Oh, yeah.
It's the kind of charming where there could be a very dark side to him.
Right.
And that plays very heavily in this film.
Continuing on, who else we got?
Fourth build, we have Michelle Williams. Most people know from television's Dawson's Creek, or at least I do. She was also in Brokeback Mountain.
That was the one thing I was going to name of hers.
I mean, she's proving herself to be a very competent actress, but...
She doesn't have much to do in this film.
Yeah, but what she does, I'm not... I had some issues. But anyway, yeah. She plays Dolores Chennault, Marshall Daniels' wife,
mm-hmm.
Leonardo DiCaprio's wife. We have Emily Mortimer, who we know as
Phoebe. I have hollow bones, like a bird.
Careful, my bones.
On 30 Rock.
Yes.
She's been in other things, I'm sure.
Yeah, she's been in a lot of great... Like, have you seen Lars and the Real Girl?
No.
Fantastic picture.
I feel like she was in... She was in... Click on her name. There was something she was in that I was really surprised that she was in.
Let's see. Scream 3, Match Point.
That's what it was. Match Point. Yeah, that was a really good film.
She actually has a very large... number of credits, and she's become one of the most beloved actresses out there.
Right.
But yeah, forever for us, it'll always be Camp My Bones. Forever.
And to hear her speak in this movie with an American accent.
Yeah.
I was like, where did Phoebe go?
Don't you remember that? There's that one scene in that episode, what did she say,
I was like, you don't know anything about me, so back off.
And then they did that slow back away.
What happened to your accent?
Yeah.
I don't know what you're on about.
You daft wanker. But anyway, also coming down the line, we have sixth build, Max von Sydow as Dr. Jeremiah Nehring, one of the hospital's top physicians.
We didn't say who Emily Mortimer plays.
Oh, Emily Mortimer played the escaped patient that you've heard the name of so many times in the trailers, Rachel Solando, the mm-hmm. escaped patient of the big plot.
It seems she evaporated right through the walls.
Yeah.
You remember that from the trailer, folks.
Yes.
And if you haven't seen the trailer, I actually really liked the trailer, but maybe...
I liked the later trailers. I didn't like the first trailer. I was so, like I said, insulted by how they just kind of spoon-fed everything to us that I was like, wow, fuck you, trailer.
You know, while I'm thinking of it, one thing that really struck me while watching this movie is how unlike the traditional thriller it is.
It really is. There was not a moment of fright in me. It was more just interest.
Right. You know, I expected to feel terrified in this movie, and this movie does lay on the atmosphere pretty thick. But I attribute this to what I now call the Inglourious Bastard Syndrome, which I mean as reading the source material before you see the movie. Knowing what was coming does help suck the tension out of the room. But when you just look at it from, just a film lover's standpoint and from someone who likes movies that aren't dumb, this movie has dreams within dreams.
Yes.
The most twisted plot, I don't mean in a twisted in a disturbing sense, I mean in a labyrinthine, sort of way. It has the most twisted, convoluted plot in the world.
And we mean that in a positive way.
Yeah, we do. It doesn't play the audience for morons. And I mean, yeah, the twist at the end is
the quote-unquote twist.
The quote-unquote twist is, I guess, when you look at it like that, vaguely insulting that they would go with something so obvious. But like I said, that's Dennis Lehane's fault, not Martin Scorsese's.
Right.
And again, like we've been saying...
I can't even blame Dennis Lehane. I'm still going to stick with whoever made that trailer needs to be smacked in the face.
Right. I like that it doesn't... The trailer may have spoon-fed you, but the movie doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
And I really, really respect it for that. You see so many terrible thrillers.
Gosh,
so
you
many.
Do.
they all think we're so stupid. Like, they think that they can make the most twisty plots in the world, and they're like, oh, it's a thriller. But when you look at it logically, it all falls apart. This movie is so smartly constructed that its little elements all make sense. And yeah. I thought that of the book, too. So that was just my little comment there that ended up in a vague rant.
No, it's fine. It's, going into it, for me, I was really kind of expecting... I didn't know what to expect. You read the book, but I didn't, obviously. Ooh, pardon me. Burp. You read the book, but I went into it. You don't have to edit that out.
No. Just burped.
Yeah. Ooh, sounds like a peep toad. But it's not summer! Anyway... No. I went to this movie kind of almost expecting a supernatural element.
Yeah, the
that was another thing about the trailers that I kind of hate the trailer for now is that and this actually goes for even the later trailers. They really kind of laid it on thick that it was going to be some sort of supernatural.
And you know how they were able to pull that off is the richness of Scorsese's imagery, Teddy's memories, his hallucinations. They're so vivid with all those... Did you notice how really rich the colors were?
Yeah,
and how beautifully photographed they all were? They clearly couldn't have been happening in real life. And it would have been so easy to be like, oh, it's a ghost story. Because, you know, there's like those shots of the papers flying around the empty room and him turning his head, you know, and no one being in the room.
Yeah,
and, you know, stuff like that. You know, the blood and the and all that stuff, you know. So, yeah, like you said, it's all coming down to poor marketing.
It really is.
So much bad marketing these days.
We have, and I got to tell you, it almost has me concerned for this film's success. As Nick would say, we are recording this on the day of release, and I'm really interested and kind of nervous to see the box office take on Monday because, I mean, this movie was. I mean, we had a pretty packed room.
Yeah.
When we saw it.
And we were there at a 5 o'clock showing.
5 o'clock showing.
So I can only imagine what the view at the showing's like 7, 9 are going to look like today.
Yeah,
I think it'll do well, at least for its first weekend, but I don't know how long it's going to last.
Yeah. I'm really concerned about the... just trailer makers. There are not many good ones left. There really aren't.
Making a trailer is an art. I mean, nobody really seems to realize that all of these things that we take for granted, trailers, posters... When's the last time you saw a really classic movie poster? I mean, movie posters are an art form just like anything else, and a really good poster is visually interesting and grabs your eye, and I wouldn't say the poster for Shutter Island is anything spectacular.
No,
but it's not bad, but it's not terrible.
Posters can be very good. Watchmen?
Yeah, the Watchmen.
A lot of good posters.
No, well, not... Well, yeah, some of them are really good.
Which I kind of only said so I could segue into this. Jackie Earle Haley is also in this picture.
Yeah, we were getting really off track here.
That was a cheap little segue.
It was, but, you know...
Jackie Earle Haley plays mutilated patient George Noyce.
They really credit him as mutilated patient George Noyce?
On Wikipedia, they do.
Oh, okay. Wikipedia has done something funny here where they tell you the name of the patient and then, like, describe the patient.
Is that a mistake?
No, it's just sort of unusual. You don't normally see on cast lists, like, Leonardo DiCaprio as Jack, the love interest.
Yeah.
You know, we don't need to know that, but anyway, continue.
Danny Nucci as whatever his name was, the Italian stereotype. Titanic.
Right.
Oh, Jack, we're going to America. Will they have pizza in America? He's just so such a horrible stereotype.
Oh, well, James Cameron has never been known for dialogue or acting, so...
Neither has Danny Nucci.
No.
Anyway, but yes, Jackie Earle Haley, who's just, you know, continuing to prove himself wonderful. But as we were discussing after the film was over, let's tone it down a bit with the Jackie Earle Haley.
He's really sort of like not plummeted, he's sort of rocketed, the exact opposite of plummeted, into like stardom. You know, he's had so many high-profile gigs in a row. Little Children, kinda. I mean, people have heard of it.
Yeah.
Not necessarily seen it, although he was really good in it.
Yeah.
Watchmen, now this, and soon to be the reboot of Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, like Freddy Krueger.
Freddy Krueger. I mean, his career is really taking off.
Which could be good or bad.
I think he's an excellent actor.
No, I do too. I certainly do.
So let's see.
But as we said, he needs to lose the molestache.
Yeah, the molestache.
The molestache.
I am creepy. Delighted that that is a phrase that exists.
I can't believe you've never heard of molestache before this. Also on deck, we have Ted Levine as the warden of the hospital. Apparently he doesn't have a name, according to this.
Yeah, he's just the warden. And he's the warden in the book, too. He's just
Ted Levine, who most people will remember as playing James Gum in
AKA
Silence of the Lambs.
Bill. Yeah,
yes.
Silence of the Lambs.
He's the fellow who tucked his cock back.
He is. That is the scene that my mother... That's the scene that scares my mother most in Silence of the Lambs. It's that scene where he's in the basement.
Yeah, I've never seen that movie, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we'll rectify that one day, sir, because it is amazing. It's an amazing film.
That is one movie that I have been nervous and terrified to ever watch.
That's because it's a terrifying movie, but it's so good. Even if you never watch it again, you at least
need to see it. But also, were you aware that he has had a regular role for the past 9 seasons? And, I mean, it's over now, but he was one of the stars of Monk with Tony Shalhoub.
I didn't know that.
He was the police captain, I believe.
Huh. I can see that.
Yeah, yeah. We also have John Carroll Lynch. He's one of my favorites. I don't know if I got to mention that earlier. As McPherson, the deputy warden of the hospital. John Carroll Lynch, who, we noted in that review especially that Scorsese cast, as you described it, was a cast of psycho killers.
Yeah. I read this review of the movie, and I'm a nerd like that where I read movie reviews before the movie comes out because it's a good way for me to gauge whether I want to see it. You know, based on what other people have seen, you know, they don't always give the movie away, but they talk about its merits as a film.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like that. But this review was mentioning that Scorsese has cast in all the secondary roles people who have played killers in other famous movies. Like there's Ted Levine from Silence of the Lambs, John Carroll Lynch from Zodiac. There's a third person, and I can't remember who it is. And it might have been Jackie Earle Haley, actually.
Yeah, yeah. He might have been thinking about Little Children.
Little Children and upcoming Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, yeah.
Although he is arguably a psychopath in Watchmen. So that just sort of, even though they're not necessarily playing crazy people here, it sort of subliminally makes the audience uneasy because in our collective perception, that's how we think of them.
Indeed.
As psychopaths.
But of course, I love John Carroll Lynch, and I don't know if you remember this, for playing Steve Carey, brother of Drew Carey on The Drew Carey Show.
Never watched The Drew Carey Show.
Well, you missed out on some delightful comedy, but he played Steve, who was his transvestite older brother.
Very nice.
Very often seen in a dress. He married Mimi.
Well, you will obey protocol. That's the one line.
Surrender your firearms. He's got that John
Man, the
Kennedy
Boston,
accent.
The Boston accents, you know.
Do you find them debatable?
It seems like Leonardo DiCaprio just loved his accent from The Departed so much that he kept it for this movie.
Yeah.
And he was like the only really thick Boston accent in the whole movie.
I would argue John Carroll Lynch was laying on pretty thick as well.
Yeah, he was. I mean, but, you know, Mark Ruffalo didn't quite.
Yeah.
That's not really important.
Hey, boss.
Hey, boss. Yeah.
Oh.
So good.
Yeah.
So wonderful.
But anyway, yes. Also, uncredited in the big credits at the conclusion of the film. You have the big credits.
Yeah.
First credits. Elias Koteas, star of stage and screen. We know him as Casey Jones.
In Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1 and 3.
Yes, but here he plays Andrew Laidis.
Yes, he does.
They don't have a description for him.
No, they don't.
There's a very good reason.
There's a very good reason for that, yeah.
Also, rounding things out, we have Patricia Clarkson as... I actually don't know if I should tell them that, because that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, see, I was wondering what we were going to say when we got to Patricia Clarkson. Let me just mention, though, before we debate, while we're debating whether or not we should tell the listeners who she is, she was amazing.
Yes, she was.
She's in one scene, and she almost steals, like, the movie as far as secondary characters are concerned, because she's just so good. And she does more than almost any other character in laying the paranoia thick on this movie.
She really does.
Like, she casts everything that you've seen before into really suspicious light. And the whole movie, to me, like you said, it's about the journey. And the journey is a very paranoid one. Scorsese's goal here is to make you question everything you see from the get-go. It's like one analogy I read was, he's making you examine every thread of the rug that he's about to pull out from under you. So, like, I think that's a very good analogy
Okay.
Really?
I'm still having a hard... I'm telling you, I'm still having a hard time with the telegraphed, quote-unquote, twist. As much as I love the movie, I'm still a bit miffed.
Okay, as of this recording, we are... I don't know how long this will be after editing, but we are 26 and a half minutes in. So do you want to go ahead and discuss the plot and possibly spoilers and just drop the giant nuke now?
Before we do that, I've got one more thing I want to comment on.
Okay.
The film's screenwriter, Laeta Kalogridis.
That is such a weird name, and I've never heard of this person.
I have, and I will tell you why. Laeta Kalogridis, which I'm probably mispronouncing,
I assume she's Greek.
I believe so. She was the creator and executive producer of one of my favorite canceled TV shows by the name of Birds of Prey. I've discussed Birds of Prey with you before, yes?
Yes, you have.
Birds of Prey, which if you folks don't remember, was a wonderful show that used to come on the WB back when that was still a thing. It was kind of a pseudo spinoff of Smallville, but not really.
It was vaguely related to the Superman mythos?
No, it was related to the Batman mythos.
Smallville is Superman.
No, I'm talking about Birds of Prey.
Right, but then why did you say Smallville?
Because they make... It had
you confuse me.
I will explain. Birds of Prey had the same production company, same production team, same executive producer, a lot of the same writers as Smallville, but it was set in the Batman universe, and the way it was connected to Superman, or to Smallville specifically, was just one line in the pilot, which was... Well, I'll explain the show to explain the line. It was a show, it was set in the near future, and it was about Gotham City after, like, Batman... It's sort of a... There's part of it that is taken from The Killing Joke.
Right.
Not to go off on a tangent about Birds of Prey, but I feel like as soon as I saw that Laeta Kalogridis, however I'm going to keep pronouncing it, was the writer of this film, I was like, holy shit.
And even so you were... I was terrified you were going to say, oh man, Laeta Kalogridis... Oh man, she's done terrible work, and I was so trepidatious.
No. That was one of the key things that really got me excited about this movie was that she had written it,
and she did a good job.
She certainly did.
As someone who's read the book, I can tell you that is a very difficult novel to adapt, and she did a damn good job.
Yeah, but Birds of Prey, like I said, it's set in the near future in the Batman universe. In that universe, the Joker has it's shortly after the Joker has shot Barbara Gordon and paralyzed her to make her Oracle. Right. She's not Batgirl anymore. You know about that.
Yeah.
He has murdered Selina Kyle, or Catwoman, because he's trying to kill like all the people that matter the most to Bruce Wayne. And it turns out in this universe, this is actually not as it is in the comics, but they did it in the TV series, they have a daughter. Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle have a love child named Helena.
Bonham Carter?
No, Helena Kyle. And she takes on the mantle of Huntress after Batman or Bruce Wayne leaves Gotham. He kind of goes into a self-imposed exile because he's so the death of Selina Kyle has just kind of driven him crazy, in essence. And he leaves New Gotham and leaves them without a savior, basically. And so Helena Kyle and Oracle, Barbara Gordon, team up to form this new group called the Birds of Prey. And there's Huntress and Oracle, and then they take in a young runaway, Dinah, with powers of her own that she's only just now beginning to explore. Whatever the narration is at the beginning of the show. It's about Gotham City, and people have... And there are these people who are meta. They have powers. They're meta. Meta-human. And the line about Smallville is... the teenage runaway, Dinah. When she comes in, they're explaining to her how she has her psychic ability. And Huntress, played by Ashley Scott, adorable... says something about there's been some interesting side effects from meteor rocks, and that's the vague tie into Smallville.
That was kind of disappointing after all that build up.
Don't edit it out, please.
I shan't,
because I want to. Because I was very excited
to know about Laeta Kalogridis,
and I want them to know about Birds of Prey because it is available on DVD, the complete series. Finally, it took a long time to get there, but after Dark Knight hit, they were like, we should put out every Batman thing we can. Unfortunately, the DVD set for that show, they've changed a lot of the music, including the awesome theme song, and changed it to some really lame Sheryl Crow-ish sound-alike bullshit that's terrible. But Birds of Prey.
Laeta Kalogridis.
Yes, I'm really sorry I went on that tangent.
That's all right.
But now that we've said all that, do you want to go on a spoiler plot rant?
Do you want to talk about just the plot, the basics of the plot, or do you think the plot is even that important? Do you think it's just a mechanism that, that Scorsese hangs what he's really interested in upon?
I don't know. I don't know, man. It's like she evaporated right through the walls, okay?
It is. As I'm sure you saw from the trailer, we might as well just tell them what it's about.
We'll tell them the,
I wasn't going to, spoil it.
Yeah, we'll tell them the public plot.
The public plot is Federal Marshal Teddy Daniels and Mark Ruffalo come to Shutter Island to investigate the disappearance of a prisoner, Rachel Solando. It's as if she evaporated right through the walls. And so as they are investigating the island, Teddy becomes convinced that there are goings-on here. The orderlies and the staff, they know more than they're letting on. Something sinister is going on here with medical experiments and drugs and possible Cold War, you know, ghost operatives and Nazi experiments.
Conspiracies!
Conspiracies! So much conspiracy. But of course...
Railroads!
Yes. Shutter Island is really about to become Train Island.
No, none of that was true. After railroads, it turned into complete bullshit just then. But
yes,
no.
Your choo-choos are safe. So yeah, of course...
My murdered parents!
But of course, this being a thriller, nothing is what it initially seems to be. Even the things that seem initially like they aren't what they seem to be.
Yeah, it's an ever-rolling ball of, that's not that thing, nor is that, nor is that!
Exactly.
Yes.
So, like you've been saying, you know, it's less the plot than the journey, but I feel like we can only tap dance around the twist for so long. Do you want to talk about the music first?
Oh, gosh, yes. Let's talk about the music, because remember, that was the first thing I actually commented on when we stood outside the theater.
I want to say, before we even talk about the music, that the music supervisor was Robbie Robertson. And if see his name on there, because I want to make sure it's the same person.
Well, when I think Robbie Robertson, I think of the co-editor of the Daily Bugle in the Spider-Man universe.
I think of the lead guitarist of the band, and I want to make sure if that's the same
person.
That
would be him.
Yeah, this guy who was in the band. They were a famous Canadian band, but they played like Americana. They were really famous. They played with Bob Dylan for a long time. Robbie Robertson was like the big head honcho of the band. They're really famous.
Yeah.
He was the music supervisor and helped Scorsese pick all the music out for this. And anybody who's familiar with Scorsese knows that he's not really a big fan of scores. He had a score for Taxi Driver, but that's really the only movie of his I can name that has a score.
I have a whole thing about Martin Scorsese right here. Martin Scorsese was hired to direct The Last Waltz based on his use of music in Main Streets. The two lived together during the editing of Waltz and became friends. Scorsese had admitted that during the editing process, the two of them heavily used drugs. Scorsese hired Robertson to compose the musical score for his 1980 film Raging Bull. And in the years since the two have been frequent collaborators, Robertson would later work on Scorsese's movies The King of Comedy, The Color of Money, Casino, and The Departed, and act as executive music director for Gangs of New York, and of course, music coordinator for this picture.
Yeah, and the music that he's picked for this, I mean, normally everybody associates the Rolling Stones with Martin Scorsese.
Which I didn't know about until The Departed.
I mean, he uses Gimme Shelter in, like, every movie ever.
He really does. But,
and
I was kind of...
He even directed that Stones documentary, Shine a Light.
Yeah.
So what's really surprising is there's not a rock song to be heard in this movie.
No,
it's it's avant-garde classical music the whole time.
And some old-time jazz.
I didn't hear any old-time
jazz. I could have sworn I heard some old-time jazz.
Is there any old-time jazz on there?
I guess not, but I'm also seeing a Brian Eno song on the soundtrack.
Brian Eno. That's cool. Anyway, a lot of atmospherics and weird classical pieces.
Yeah.
A big heavy use of Mahler, if indeed that is Mahler there playing in the background when Mac and Teddy Daniels are... His name is not really Mark, but it's fun to say with a Boston accent. I was like, is that Brahms? No, it's Mahler. Is that really Mahler? Does it say?
I'm having a hard time finding that, actually.
Maybe they lied.
Miller, Brian Eno, Berman, Marshall Starr, Johnson, Washington, Richter. I see no Mahler.
Huh. Well, then they might have either not included it on the soundtrack or lied to us. Either way,
It was a situation of, you know, he's wrong too. It's kind of a light joke, kind of.
Well, or we just didn't sit through the credits. We didn't sit through the entire credits to see.
We didn't.
The music
I needed
was.
To get outside and stew.
And stew.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that actually is kind of an interesting idea. What were you feeling at the end of the movie if you needed to go outside and stew? Like what kind of effect did this movie have on you?
It was. To explain that would be to explain the twist, to explain the story, and get really spoilerish. So,
do we need to just do that now?
We may need to.
Okay. Giant spoiler nuke.
Booyaka 619.
Yes.
Rey Mysterio.
B12. And my favorite vitamin, I might add. Boom. Spoiler nuke. Everything we say after this point is going to give away, like, the giant... quote-unquote twist.
Yes.
And everything that leads up to it in this movie. So if you haven't seen the movie yet and are intrigued, turn the podcast off and come back once you've seen it, because I cannot guarantee when we'll be done talking about
it. That's a good way to do it, yeah.
So, go.
Okay. My reaction immediately following the film was based... It was really... I didn't know if I needed to feel sad for... we'll go ahead and say it, Andrew Landis, as played by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Ooh! We should just tell them what the twist is. As it turns out, Andrew Latus... We're going too far ahead.
I'll do it. Because remember, I'll go explain the thing about the trailer. When the trailer first hit, I was watching it and I was like, well, duh, trailer. Leonardo DiCaprio is the 67th patient. You know, because remember they were like, there's a 67th patient. They were really hammering that home, and I was like, duh, he's crazy too. Duh. I was kind of, like I said, I felt insulted. I felt like, are you calling me stupid?
Right.
I was like, how dare you, trailer? And having seen it, I mean, that is just, it does turn out to be the case. But there's a much deeper bit of the story, as it turns out that Andrew Laidis, the character played by Elias Koteas, who we are told throughout the film is responsible for the death of Leonardo DiCaprio's character's wife, he is in fact also Andrew Laidis. Andrew Laidis, the firebug, if you will, that he describes, that was played by Elias Koteas with a big scar and staples in his head, is in fact just like a supplementary personality that he created in his head to kind of allay his guilt.
What happened was his wife was a manic depressive.
Yes.
She burned down their apartment, and they subsequently moved to like this pretty house by the lake.
Yeah.
He was, in the book, they do a somewhat better job of explaining this, why he's so like drinking all the time.
Yeah.
But he's drunk all the time. He refuses to accept that his wife has mental problems, and he just ignores all the warning signs. Everybody's telling him, man, your wife needs help. Your wife needs help. And he's like, no, 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 no. I'm going to keep drinking. She just completely snaps one day and drowns their three children.
Yeah.
He comes home and is so devastated by this that he kills her.
Yeah.
He shoots her. And he snaps after
as you would expect.
After this heavily traumatic event, and has constructed this elaborate fantasy that Andrew Laidis burned down their apartment, this... himself transferred into this supplementary person.
That his wife died in the fire.
That his
not
wife
afterward.
Died in the fire. Not. Yeah. And Rachel Solando is another character he invented to explain the death of the children. They weren't his kids. They were her kids.
Yeah.
So he's invented several characters in this elaborate fantasy world to allay his own guilt. And at the end of the movie, they rush all of this at him like, no, you've invented this for yourself. And the reason we've let you out on the island is because we've constructed this elaborate role-playing game in the hopes that if you were to act out your fantasy, you would realize just how fake and crazy it is and regain sanity just by sheer force. We will force sanity back into you.
Which, now that we're done with that and still saying this is a great movie, can I tell you that I take issue with that and the way it's explained to him?
Okay, go ahead.
Listen.
I did make it sound kind of stupid right
there.
They
made it sound unbelievably stupid because I was like, wow. Like, you know, we've constructed this whole elaborate, and I'm like, that is cartoonishly unreal. I don't believe that they would actually do that. I can't, nothing in the world can make me believe that even, or maybe I just have so little faith in the medical profession, but I'm just like, I don't think anyone would take that much time to create, to help someone, to help someone live out this massive fantasy of theirs, someone who would give them such a massive layout of this huge, you know, mental institution and let them play out this fantasy. I think that's bullshit. I'm like, there's no way that would ever really happen. Like, I know one of the great aspects of film is, of course, suspension of disbelief. It's something that comes up quite a bit. But there was a certain facet of that that I had a hard time swallowing.
I mean, they make a big deal about, you know, if it didn't work with you, we'd lose all our funding and they'd shut us down and they want to prove that lobotomy is not the answer, and they want to...
Because this isn't in, like, the very early days of most psychological...
Yeah, and this is the early days of pharmacology as well. He's like, I don't want to drug everyone into submission, and I don't want to, you know, stuck an ice pick through their eye. I want to use talk and reason to make them come to
terms. Yeah, Ben Kingsley, he has that line I told you about. This.
I think what it comes down to is that it was just a severe last resort. And it was either this or nothing. And they've had a doctor, Lester Sheehan, following Teddy the whole time just to make sure he doesn't really get into trouble.
And playing his partner, Chuck Owl.
Yeah, there's the other big twist there. He's actually a doctor.
Mark Ruffalo, there you go.
So anyway, continue.
Well, I had a problem with that, but the moment that it really, like, I was like, wow. When did this turn into a cartoon? When did that happen? The moment that I had that thought was the moment where Ben Kingsley pulls out the marker board that has the names on it. I'm like, Wow, really?
that was actually the only moment that rang false to me.
Because he has the little like pointer stick.
I was willing to suspend my disbelief, but he had the board covered with the sheet so that he could dramatically unveil it. Look at this board.
And he had a pointer stick. And in addition, that device, which I'll explain now, what it turns out, and I mean if you really thought about it and stared at these names for long enough, you might have figured it out yourself. Edward Daniels and Andrew Laidis, they're an anagram. Dolores
Chennault
and Rachel Salando, another anagram.
He could have explained that without the use of the whiteboard. He could have just said Andrew Laidis, Edward Daniels, they're anagrams.
It felt like a joke. You see this? They're anagrams. It almost felt like Stewie Griffin was explaining this to him.
To me, the ultimate use of anagrams is in Rosemary's Baby. Have you ever seen that?
No.
With the anagrams, there's a really effective use of anagrams in Rosemary's Baby. And the reason it's so chilling is because she's doing it with Scrabble tiles. And you watch her. The camera just sort of stays on the Scrabble tiles as she scrambles it into the correct word. And that's really cool. But they don't even do that in this movie. He doesn't even write it on the board.
He already has it written down and set up so he could do some massive cartoonish presentation.
I wouldn't go so far as to say cartoonish, but I think it was somewhat unintentionally comedic.
No, the reason why I say cartoonish, I want to tell you exactly what it reminded me of. Have you seen the episode of South Park with the underpants gnomes?
Yes.
It so rang up to me, I was like... Underpants? Profit! Step one, underpants. Step two, ? Step three, profit. It felt exactly like that. I was like, wow, underpants gnomes. Ben Kingsley.
Hear that, Martin Scorsese? You turned Ben Kingsley into an underpants gnome.
Well, I think other films did that first.
Blood Rain plus ? Profit.
Jeez.
How about quality?
Gosh.
There was no quality.
All that being said, Ben Kingsley is awesome in this movie.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But I just, that was the one.
That little presentation is in the book, too. So, again, Leda Kalogeridis did such a good job, such a faithful job of adapting it that really... It's Dennis Lehane's problem, that he put that in the book. And, of course, in a book, you're not watching it happen on screen. So he's like, watch me unscramble these for you. In a book, it kind of works. Not so much on screen.
The other thing that I took issue with, and I can't believe I forgot to mention it when we were discussing music just now, there's that one cue. When Mark Ruffalo and Leonardo DiCaprio first arrive at Shutter Island, there is this huge, booming, like, sinister fanfare that plays as they're being driven through the gates.
And it's a really creepy piece of music, but it was laying it on way too thick.
Way too early
into the movie. It needed, like you said, something creepy and tingly and not, like, bam in your face.
Yeah. But you'll know these are only two major problems.
But you were going to explain why you needed to go brood after the movie. We sort of got sidetracked onto what the twist actually was.
Okay, just because... And because they You say that the book makes it clear that like the way they present it in the movie is the way it is, and there's no question. It's just it is the way it is. But this movie lets it. I feel that it leaves it somewhat ambiguous.
Oh yeah, totally.
That either it really is true that he's created this supplementary idea in his head that he really is Andrew Laidis, and that all of this has been something he created to help him cope, or that this really is a conspiracy, and he's just kind of, like, giving in, and he's just like, I'll just die now because I don't want to be thinking about this anymore. Like, he's giving in to their conspiracy at the end. So it's either he's giving in to the conspiracy, or it's tragic because he hasn't changed and he does have to have a lobotomy.
To me, the real revelation of the book is not that he's crazy. I saw that coming from the beginning.
Yeah.
Everybody saw that coming from the beginning.
Trailer makers certainly did.
Oh, yes. Yeah. To me, the twist was that we've had this breakthrough before, 9 months ago. We broke through to you before, but you regressed. And we're trying to keep it so that you don't regress again.
But at the same time, it could also still be bullshit.
And so the end of the book, the movie adds one big-ish thing to this scene. The book ends with him outside on the steps with Chuck, and it appears that he has regressed.
Yeah.
And that's a sublimely creepy moment. The movie adds hints that they're about to go lobotomize him.
They have him, like, slowly being kind of carted away. I mean,
he walks off with them, but you see an orderly walking across the field with something sharp sticking out of a bunch of cloth, and you know that Nering, played by Max von Sydow, is clearly a practitioner of the old school. And you see how defeated Ben Kingsley looks. So what's going on there? You know, sort of.
Yeah, it's...
Did he regret... I mean, the thing is, if you're going to say if this is a conspiracy, I would like you to explain that, because if it is a conspiracy, then what the hell have we been watching for the last 2 hours?
The way I viewed it, and this is... Listen, I'm as divided as anyone else. I'm not... Because I'm not picking either side. I'm not... And I'm not saying I'm more on either side. I'm saying I'm completely split. What I'm saying is if it is a conspiracy... I think you have that scene, right, where he kind of wakes up from his hallucination and they explain everything to him, and they have that bit about, you know, 9 months ago and you regressed and blah, blah, blah. And when that happens, and when he's sitting on the stairs and he's talking to Mark Ruffalo and saying, like, you know, we got to get off this island, Chuck. And I'm like, as soon as I hear him say that, I'm thinking that he is sort of demented. I mean, there's no questioning that, but I'm imagining that what has happened here is that, like, maybe...
Maybe he played along with them?
Maybe he and Mark Ruffalo played along with them. Like, that maybe... Because when he first arrives at the lighthouse, mm-hmm. and Ben Kingsley's just sitting there at his desk, it feels like, you know, oh, they knew he was going to try this. They set up everything, and they had him at the desk, and his stupid cartoon whiteboard. They had it all there because they knew he was going to swim over to the island and punch that one guy in the face and come in and walk up the stairs and keep going indoors with a gun. It's like they planned that. But by the same token, it could be like, you know, one of those, you know, I know that you know that I know that you know that I know situations where it's like he knew they would try to fake him out. And so he stuck to his resolve, and he was really talking to Mark Ruffalo like, yeah, I was just bullshitting them. I was totally bullshitting them. I still think they're fuckers. Let's kill them. You know, like, let's get off this island. You know, like, I really thought, like, they could have gone either way with that. And that's why I'm saying I'm completely split. Is that this is why I needed a moment to reflect. Because I was like, there's the one half of me that's really sad because what a tragedy this man. There really is no hope for him. He's too far gone. And there's the other half of me that's like, no, wait, the conspiracy remains.
But, of course, there then remains the evidence that he never finds anything that really supports that, yes, there are experiments here. Yes, there are Nazi scientists here. And, yes, you know, everything is just as weird as it says. And how would Ben Kingsley know that line, baby, why are you wet? Why would Ben Kingsley
know
that?
What I was thinking in that moment was that's like a line that he fed to him through like, you know, just like suggestion and therapy. Was it like he helped him create that illusion, and by in the process of doing that, like, actually kind of created, quote unquote, the dialogue of his hallucination?
Right. And what do you think that would, seeing it as a conspiracy, what does that make you think about the scene with Patricia Clarkson? Should we go ahead and say what the deal
is? Patricia Clarkson plays the woman who is the real, and I put that in quotes again, real Rachel Solando, who's been living...
Turns out Emily Mortimer's Rachel Solando is a nurse who was playing Rachel Solando.
As part of either the conspiracy or as part of the illusion they were creating to
help fix him.
Either way. But Patricia Clarkson is living in a cave on the side of the island, like, I'm going to assume eating rats to live, and, you know, like, with a fire, and telling him this whole thing about the experiments and the way they do business and... You know, the way I viewed it, especially, like, there's that part, like, at the end when he first comes into the lighthouse and he's talking to Ben Kingsley, and he says that thing about, you know, I met her. She's living on a cave on the side of the island. I was like, you jackass! Why did you just tell me that? They're going to go get her, you idiot! I was pissed. I was like, you fucker! you know, like, I was like, you just gave her away.
Yeah, but she's like, well, I move every day.
Exactly, but see, at the same time, like, that makes me question that, because I'm like, okay, maybe she does move every day. She's still out there. You see what I'm saying? Like, I feel it is entirely possible to go either way with this movie. The only thing that really, I think, pushes the point that they want us to really think it is really that he is just too far gone, the music. I don't think they would play such tragic music. Because I think if it were like that they were, that, you know, the conspiracy's real and that he's going to be lobotomized, forced lobotomized, I think if it was that it was still a conspiracy, I think the music would have been a bit creepier.
Right. But and of course, that if it was a conspiracy, wouldn't Chuck try to save him at the end?
Maybe it was all part of their plan. I mean, I don't know. Like, it just... Maybe I'm just...
You know what? That's amazing, though, that movie is fucking with your head like that. I think that's the whole point. Even though you saw the twist coming in the trailer, that movie still fucked with your head.
I think it might be a personal thing where I'm just like, I'm so thirsty for justice in most situations that I'm like, I'm willing to believe these two guys are just that badass... that they've come up with this whole plan where we're going to let them catch me, and then we're going to do this thing, and then we're going to do this thing, and then we're probably going to kill some people and get the fuck off this island. Like, that's what I'm thinking the whole time. Like, I'm like, oh, this is all planned. This is all their plan. It's everything's going according to plan. Like,
because it's all part of the plan.
Can I smack you right now?
No. No, I felt that was an appropriate reference.
No, I'll accept it. I will accept it. But no, I mean, I talked for a long time just then.
It's all right. That's good. I wanted to get to the meat of this movie.
I'll give you the meat of the movie.
I'll bring something zesty to your mouth. Standout moments, standout performances. Do you have anything? I mean, what do you think about, like, say, Max von Sydow?
Max von Sydow, I don't think I've ever memorably seen him in anything. He's just always been an actor who, when you hear the name, you immediately think creepy shit is about to go down.
And he certainly helps in this movie.
Actually, I would disagree.
Really?
I felt that was something that kind of took me aback, is that the way Max von Sydow plays his character, he plays him with the same kind of charm and, like, I feel like there's that scene where Leonardo DiCaprio and Mark Ruffalo first walk into Ben Kingsley's office, and the camera around the chair, and Max von Sydow's sitting there. I thought that the implication of that scene was supposed to be that, you know, DiCaprio is just so scarred from dealing with, you know, having to, you know, fight off the Nazis and the thing at Dachau in the war, that he is just kind of traumatized by the very thought of Germans, and that it's actually just a prejudice that he has for him, and okay, that Max von Sydow is actually a decent guy. He's just been laid with this bad stereotype.
Right. I think that the movie was trying to do it the other way around. I think you are probably approaching it with a bit more perception than other people. The dumb, brainy smarties, you know.
Yeah.
They were probably meant to think that Nazis, hints of Nazi experiments, he's got a vaguely Germanic accent. What are we supposed to think about that?
But I wasn't going there. I was going, maybe he's just prejudiced.
Maybe. And that actually makes some sense, because really, he kind of lays on the World War II pretty thick.
Yeah, but like I said, it's all about that, and the fact that, like I said, I think Max von Sydow plays his character with the same kind of charm and caring that Ben Kingsley plays his. There's not a moment in Max von Sydow's actual performance that suggests to me that he's got a dirty little secret.
Well, there's that part where he's in the conference room and he's like, let's chain them in manacles to the floor. Let's chain everybody in manacles. And Ben Kingsley is like, but they'll all drown. And he's like, well, if we don't, then they'll, you know, wreak havoc on us, you know. You know, that scene sort of makes you think.
I didn't think about that. That's a good one. That's a good point.
And, you know, he's got, like, that syringe in his pocket that he's, like, you know, like, don't you agree that when you see a monster, you must stop it going somewhere? You know, like, I felt like he had, I felt like he wasn't as scary as I was anticipating him being, but I did feel like there was an edge of menace there.
Well, in a weird way, I almost want to kind of say, what if that's another, like, little part of the game, you know? Maybe Max von Sydow is intended to make Leonardo DiCaprio distrust him. That, like, I know that this may be stretching it. That they were like, okay, wait, Max von Sydow. As soon as Leo enters the room, say that crazy ass thing about the shackles. And then, you know, like, 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 I don't think they went that far, but I'm just like, I honestly feel like in terms of my idea about the elaborate plans and schemes of everyone, is that maybe he was intended to play it. I feel like Ben Kingsley and Max von Sydow is like, listen, Max von Sydow. Because, you know, when he talks to him, he calls him by the actor's name.
Right, not the character.
Not the character. He's like, listen, Max von Sydow. What we're going to do is, since you've got that vaguely German accent, and this fella just came back from the war, we're going to kind of help him out here. You're going to be a villain. And he's like, oh, what a role. You know, like, you know, it's just like...
I like that within the universe of the movie, they talk like that. Yeah. What a role. Oh, it's the role of a lifetime.
Exactly.
As, like, head neurosurgeon, it is my ultimate... It'll be my greatest acting challenge to date. Evil neurosurgeon. Going somewhere.
Maybe...
Manacles.
Maybe I'm...
You're very good defense mechanisms.
Maybe
you're men of violence.
Maybe I'm crazy, too. I think that's entirely possible, because I've just... I don't know.
You know what, though? You've made me think of something. The achievement of this film. If the whole point of his delusions, if he is indeed delusional, is that he constructed this elaborate fantasy world. Aren't you just doing the same thing with these thoughts of conspiracies? That it's all a conspiracy? Haven't you yourself
sort of become... Yeah, but at the same time, what does that say about me?
Well, I'm not saying it says anything. I'm just saying, doesn't that just prove that the movie is more smartly constructed than we first gave it credit for?
No, I never didn't give it credit for its construction.
Well, as thinking about it, we've realized it has some
layers. Yeah, I feel like we've certainly gained an even bigger appreciation through this discussion.
Yeah. What did you think of Ted Levine?
Ted Levine...
Because he has, like, one scene in the movie, and it's kind of random, and in the book, he's, like, this malevolent, like, figure who's just sort of hovering on the periphery, but he only has, like, one scene in this movie.
Yeah, the fact that they just referred him as the warden kind of gives him this strange, reputation, I guess. Much like the warden in The Shawshank Redemption.
Right.
Like, you know, where, I mean, he had a name, but I'm just saying, like, it's a very similar situation.
In the book, he's, like, much more evil. He's, like, that thing about, if I were to bite into your eye right now, would you, like...
Would you be able to stop me in time?
Before I blinded you?
Holy shit.
Like, in the book, he's all, like, in his face and, like, urgh. In the movie, he... It's sort of interesting that you brought up Max von Sydow's sort of charm, because Ted Levine plays that as charming as you could play somebody asking another human being.
I disagree. I think Ted Levine played it as creepy as he could possibly play it.
Yeah, but he wasn't.
Because it's just like, oh, I'm regular Joe, security guard guy. I'm the warden. I also have crazy thoughts about violence and biting people's eyes out.
Well, that's like, the only creepy part, but like the whole time he's driving, he's just like, we're violent men. I'm as violent as you are. We are like the same. And then when he stops the car, he's like, if I were to bite into your eye, would you be able to stop me before I blinded you?
What the fuck? Like,
and then Leonardo DiCaprio's like...
I think you heard me audibly go, what the fuck?
And then Leonardo DiCaprio's like, give it a try. And you're like, snap.
Yeah.
Leonardo DiCaprio. I'd like to see Ted Levine and Leonardo DiCaprio duke it out.
Yeah, yeah. That'd be some interesting stuff.
Yeah. But anyway, I just wanted to see what you thought about that scene because it's sort of random and but it still has, you know, an effect.
Yeah, yeah, it was massively creepy. That just furthered my idea about the conspiracy, really.
That they were manufacturing it?
Yeah.
Of course, then the question then becomes, if it is a conspiracy, what are they covering up? Everything that Solando said?
Everything that Solando said, or something even more sinister.
Because there's no evidence.
If you go on the conspiracy route, I think that actually makes the movie more terrifying, where you're like, seriously, what the fuck are they covering up? And the fact that, like, the movie ends without that question answered, it's like, seriously, what the fuck are they covering up? Like, I think that's what they were, like, if they were going in that direction, that's what the kind of reaction I thought they were kind of trying to elicit is, but no, seriously, he was awesome. And seriously, what are they doing? Yeah, like, it's about paranoia, and it's about trapping us in this, like, area of, what the fuck is going on? Like, yeah, but as a straight movie, and as I viewed it, because I wasn't there in that mindset. I was definitely, like I said, in all honesty, to be completely truthful, while I am saying that I am 50-50 split, not entirely true. I am actually much more on the case of he really was crazy, and the ending is a tragedy.
Right. I feel the ending more supports that than the conspiracy, although the conspiracy is a very interesting train of thought.
And I think you really could go somewhere with that.
Yeah, totally.
Clearly I did.
Yeah. There were a couple of other things I wanted to discuss briefly. We don't have to talk about them in depth. I wanted to talk about how good the look of the movie was.
I'm not an aesthetics guy. And even as a film student, I'm not. And when people question my aesthetics, I'm like, fuck you. Who thinks of these things?
It was very, very creepy and industrial and very well designed and appropriately claustrophobic.
And all I can do is agree with you.
And the camera work was kind of cool in places. What did you think? I mean, you were going to mention the ADR. You mentioned it
outside
of the movie.
Holy balls. That was one of the other few, very, very few nitpicks I had with this movie was how... I don't know why, like, maybe there's ADR in other Scorsese pictures, but the ADR in certain scenes of this movie was...
Maybe you should explain to the listeners what ADR stands for.
ADR means automated dialogue re-record, or something like that. And it's something to that effect. It's basically when, you know, in the process of shooting a film with the boom mics and whatever mics they've got on the actual, you know, shooting area, that if a line does not come out clearly enough into the mic and they don't find out about it till post-production, or if... you know, they don't like the way it sounds and they want to change the way it sounds or what have you, what they'll do is they'll go into a recording studio and have the actor re-record the line and try to match it to the way he was talking before within the actual context of the scene. And the worst case of this comes also, once again, at the very beginning, right after that shitty music cue, is when John Carroll Lynch has explained to them, like, the workings of the island and, you know, the protocols and everything. There's one moment where he's explaining something to them, and, like, all of a sudden the camera is on the back of his bald head, and his voice sounds louder and more like, wow, he's not in this environment at all. This voice is being recorded in a studio, and then back to him in the front where his mouth is still moving. Like, I'm just like, oh, that's another thing I wanted to talk about. And now I'm glad I just reminded myself. Something happened on a multiple occasions in the movie. I'm going to assume that it was to add atmosphere and to continue the idea of hallucination and everything and the insanity. When they were interviewing the inmates, if you will, there was the woman who asked for the cup of water.
Yes.
She doesn't drink the water. She just takes her hand to her mouth and does this. But she doesn't have the cup in her hand.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
She's crazy.
Is that really all it was?
I think so.
Okay. But there was also the fact that, like, this movie had a great affinity for, on multiple occasions, what they would do was they would, like, especially in the hallucinations with Michelle Williams, she'd be talking and you would see her mouth moving and then you'd cut to a different shot of her and her mouth was not moving, but she was still talking. It happened there, and it also happened in the very first scene in which Leonardo DiCaprio and Mark Ruffalo are allowed to go inspect Rachel Solando's cell. Because there's that, all those intercuts where sometimes they're talking but their mouths aren't moving. And I wondered, was that a mistake? Or was that something about atmosphere?
Well, if it continued all throughout the movie, I would be inclined to say that it's not. I mean, if it happens so many times, I find it hard to believe that someone like Martin Scorsese wouldn't notice.
But at the same time, you remember what I said, another thing I said about this movie afterward, which is movies like The Departed, which are released in like October, November, are like, please give me an Oscar. And then there's these movies where it's like, I'm going to have fun.
Right.
And maybe in the pursuit of fun, he misses something. I mean, the ADR, that was like, listen, I'm, Nick, you know me. And even though I am a film major, I'm not that guy. I'm not that douchey guy who nitpicks about everything. I'm like, you know, well, the lighting in the one scene, remember, we got a print of this movie. I'm not that guy. But, you know, the ADR, really, something about it fucked with me. I was like, wait a minute, John Carroll Lynch. Your voice is not in the same tone it was when you started that sentence, and it's not the same as it is when you ended it. I'll shut up now.
We are duly appointed federal marshals. You will have to surrender your firearms.
All right.
Mac.
No, ma!
No. I think Rip Torn should have played Rachel Solando. He should have played Michelle Williams' part. God, what is a line she says? You have to let me go. Do it as Rip Torn.
You have to let me go.
I love it.
All right. Well, I feel like we've...
Yeah, I feel like we've exhausted some topics.
So,
final thoughts, then, on Shutter Island?
Final thoughts? Clearly, this movie got me thinking.
Clearly.
But it was a wonderful film. It was really great. I can't say I feel that it's as good a film as The Departed.
Well, no.
And I'm saying that, as I have to make an admittance here, those are the only two Scorsese films I've ever seen.
You haven't seen Taxi Driver?
Never seen Taxi Driver.
Really?
And I want to explain to the listeners that I did not walk into this in attempting to come off like some sort of Scorsese scholar. I know what I know. And based on those two films, Departed is better. Clearly, it won an Oscar, you know.
Right.
But I'm just saying, like, but yeah, but it just was a really great film. I feel completely satisfied. I don't. Oh, you were about to ask something.
Yeah, no, I was just about to mention. Go to the Wikipedia page. You were mentioning about releasing the film in February. This film had a lot of delays.
Oh, you raise a good point. Shutter Island was originally slated to be released on October 2nd, 2009, but Paramount pushed the release date to February 19th, 2010.
There was a reason, but I can't remember what it was.
Paramount head executive Brad Gray blamed the recent economic downturn as the main decision behind the delayed release date.
See, so maybe they would have said, give us, like, a production design Oscar, but then it got pushed back.
But at the same time, now I'm kind of sad because I'm like, it is true, the Academy kind of forgets movies that aren't recent in their heads.
The one big exception to that is Silence of the Lambs, which came out, like, in February, and they still awarded it, like, all of the big five, like, awards.
That's true.
Or big four, whatever.
But I would like to say that...
this is not Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, but I would like to say that I wish this film very well in next Oscar season, because it's a wonderful film.
I look forward to seeing it again. I feel like it's a movie you should see twice. I pretty much agree with you. It's a beautifully shot, beautifully made, very involving and creepy little film. I think it's worth your while. See it.
Yes, definitely see it.
Hopefully it will be around in theaters for a while. I think it is great on a big screen with booming speakers.
Oh, yeah.
See it.
See it. See it. Feel it. Let me reveal it. Mm. They couldn't see the hand motion, so that probably was lost on everyone.
But they got to hear the great rhyming.
I don't know why I did that at all.
Anyway, I guess to wrap this up, you have been listening to Cinemantics, the podcast about movies good and bad. Mostly bad, but not this time.
Seriously not.
You know, I always like end it with, but in this case, awesome. Yeah. You know, like every episode usually ends that way. So maybe it's just mostly good.
Yeah.
But anyway, I am Nick Melton.
I'm Jeff Heatherly.
Until next time, it will appear as if we have evaporated right through the walls. James K. Polk, James K. Polk.
Seriously, he was awesome.
J. Polk, James K. Polk.
Polk.
That might be a stinger.
It might be.